Today's episode of the Open Pantry podcast is brought to you by me, Sean from Open Pantry Consulting. Make sure if you're opening a restaurant or starting to scale your restaurant that you come and check out what I'm doing at openpantryconsulting.com. Everything around operations analysis, recruitment, or data analytics. Everything to get your restaurant, cafe, or bakery on the better side of this crisis. Let's keep going with the show.
Staring down the barrel of a 60% permanent closure rate, it's time to fix what's broken.
It's time to change the game.
The hospitality industry is at a pivotal point.
And it's become painfully obvious that business acumen and
strategic planning
will matter just as much as resilience.
There's no shortage of resources, ranging from how to apply for loans to how to negotiate with your landlord.
But at some point, we will turn our sights towards the future.
And when that time comes, we'll need
tools and strategies to thrive,
not just survive.
In the hospitality industry,
we fix our own problems.
This is no different.
We've created a group
called the Hospitality Game Changers.
It's on Facebook, a platform
you already use daily.
It's a space just for us where we're tackling the most difficult issues
facing our industry and creating solutions.
It's updated daily with the most compelling audio, written, and video content
to make sure you're plugged into what's going on today
and what can help us tomorrow.
It's quick and easy and free to join.
Just log into Facebook and search
Hospitality Game Changers in the search bar.
And you're all set.
We can't change the cards that we are dealt,
but we can change
how we play the game.
Welcome to the Open Pantry podcast for yet another episode. As always, fantastic to have you listening along. So thanks so much for tuning in. I'm really excited to have a chat with our next guest, Sophia Levin, who is a culinary travel journalist and has contributed to such media brands as SBS Food, Good Food Guide, as well as Lonely Planet. And obviously, she also has her own website called seasontraveler.com, in which she invites us to eat curiously. I feel honored to spend the time with our next guest, Sophia Levin. Hey, Sophia, how are you?
Hi, I'm so good. How are you?
I'm very well. I'm trying not to butcher the intros as much, but I find I'm slowly getting better at it. So here we go. How did you start out as a food writer? Because you've obviously had such a stellar career, and it's been really exciting to do some research about you the last couple of weeks and just really understand a bit of your journey. I mean, you've got such a great voice in this industry and in Victoria and around the country. Like, how did you actually start out being a journalist in the food game?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I studied journalism, which is definitely useful, but I didn't start studying journalism straight away. Mm-hmm. I was doing a double major degree in psychology and marketing at Monash University. Mm-hmm. Going back, oh, how old am I? 10 years or so now, I think, which makes me feel a lot older than I am, I think. But I took about 9 months off, a year and a half into that degree, and went traveling, as you do when you're young and nothing matters. And during those travels around Europe and specifically North Africa to Morocco, I started writing more and more about my travel and food experiences on a great little app that people may or may not remember called Facebook Notes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
which my dad actually sent to me earlier in the year, so it still exists somewhere in the other regions of Facebook.
Really?
So, okay. Yeah, it was just my way of diarizing what I was doing so that I didn't have to check in with my parents every 24 hours as an 18-year-old woman traveling around who they were freaking out about, you know, getting lost or kidnapped or God knows what else. And I really enjoyed it. I really, really enjoyed it. And then other than the writing, the thing that really struck a chord with me was people taking action when they read what I had written. So booking a trip to Morocco or wanting to experience something a little bit different.
Yeah.
That really left an impression. So when I got back from overseas, I switched up my degree, took on a journalism major and switched the others to minors and sort of went from there.
Wow. Did it make you feel quite, must have made you feel really proud in a way that you felt you could write, you know, these great articles and then people would actually really relate to it and actually cause an action on the other end. Did that make you just, you know, feel really proud about the work that you were actually doing at that time?
Yeah, it definitely did. And I think there's definitely a lot of merit to, I'm pretty sure it's a Spider-Man quote, which it doesn't sound like, where, you know, with great power comes great responsibility.
Yes.
And that's Spider-Man, isn't it? It's one of those.
Oh, I feel like
it is. I'm an X-Men, Marvel, whatever, you know.
Yes.
It's funny because when people start actually doing what you say, especially when you're young and following your footsteps, you think, oh, shit. You know, I need to make sure that I'm doing this properly and making sure I do the stories justice, make sure the information is correct. And so it's a funny one because at the same time you're studying journalism and you're studying ethics and what's right and what's wrong and, you know, making sure that information is always balanced. But in the last 10 years, the media landscape has just changed so drastically that a lot of that, I think, does get lost or weighted too heavily one way or the other.
Yeah. Is it a challenge to still sort of create those powerful, you know, articles that are sort of a call to action, or just, you know, just great articles you feel really, really proud of that you want people to read, or you want people, you know, to watch or listen to? Like, is it hard to get that cut through now that it is so much more fragmented?
I think this is kind of where Season Traveller came from, is that a lot of the stories that I personally love writing and telling and sharing, a lot of the publications that I write for just aren't that interested in them. And I understand why to a degree. A lot of the time they might be, you know, too small time or not new enough, or it's just some little neighborhood joint that I think is really great around the corner.
Yeah.
But that doesn't necessarily have the budget or the will or even the desire to be in mainstream media.
Yeah.
And they don't have to be by any means, but I love sharing these experiences, and a lot of the restaurants and the places that I cover exist to serve the communities that surround them, often migrant communities. And I just think there's so much to learn and so much to gain from just eating food from somebody else's culture. And for me, I suppose, eating isn't necessarily about being satiated. It's about what can you learn? How can you sort of leave a table with your mind broadened and expanded as well as your stomach?
Is there kind of someone, is there somewhere where that mindset came from, Sophia? Because like my concern at the start of this crisis is that because we were going to potentially lose so many venues worldwide that we were going to lose a sense of community. Like, but you actually thinking about the fact that there is a part of community within side food venues and you know, the food that a chef will bring out will actually tell a story about where they're from or that kind of thing. Like, is there somewhere where that's become ingrained in you, or is that just the situations you've been with, you know, being in your early 20s and touring around and traveling and that kind of stuff where it came from?
I think it's probably in my DNA a little bit. I've got a Jewish background. So I grew up. I still go to my parents every Friday night our version of Shabbat, which is not exactly kosher, but it is very much about family and community. And I've done that my whole life. I'm going to my grandparents, my aunties and uncles, my folks, and now I host every now and then as well.
Awesome.
So there's always been a real gathering around food culturally for me. And then, you know, doing things like going to the market every Friday with my mum, big market, another sort of activity around food, or going for Sunday brunch with my family when, you know, the kids aren't hungover, but always catching up around food and cooking and eating. So I suppose that's always been there for me.
Yeah.
And that's just how I live.
Yeah. It's an awesome thing. I go to the Queen Vic market every Sunday, and I think if there's a time I don't do that, or something comes out of step and I just miss out, I feel like my week isn't the same. It's such an important ritual for me. So yeah, I completely understand that.
Yeah, lockdown really throws it all a bit out of whack. I need to rebuild those habits, definitely.
Oh, it was so sad. Like, I live about 4.5 kilometers from Queen Vic Market, and it was just really important for me to do that in the 5K lockdown.
And you didn't move, did you, to be within?
Well, no. Market radius. So what I did, because I was just on the 5Ks, and I decided to park a couple of streets away. So I'd be within inside the barrier and then walk the rest, because I just wanted to support them every single week. These people who, you know, weirdly have become part of my life, you know, for the last 5 years I've lived in Melbourne, and I wanted to make sure I could support them. So it was a bit of a different way to do it, but I got there. You know, as I said in the start, you do a lot of different styles of journalism. You've contributed to so many different kind of publications. Is there a kind of style or a story that you like to tell now that you've been doing this for a while?
Does it sound self-involved to say I love writing in first person?
Not at all.
I think it's something that you don't often get to do.
Mm.
For the publications you write for, you're representing a publication. Mm-hmm. It's not about you. But I find that in some of the opinion pieces that I write for Broadsheet, for example, or when I'm writing Season Traveller newsletters and articles, it's still not about me.
Yes.
When I use first person, mm-hmm. it's more about the experience. So I sort of see it as a window or a doorway in mm-hmm. for the reader into being able to be there where you are, or even to be you and relate to you.
Yes.
And I'll very much write for the audience who I believe is reading.
Mm-hmm.
It just forms, I think, a better connection, the same way you might have a host on a TV show.
Yes.
And that has a kind of different vibe to, I mean, for example, you look at, I don't know, you look at someone like Adam Leal or
yep.
Bourdain, and you're very much following their journeys.
Mm.
Whereas you watch Chef's Table on Netflix, and there's someone in the background there interviewing and asking the questions, but you never see them. It's
yeah.
all about the specific story of the person who's being interviewed.
Yes.
And I think there's a lot of merit to both of those methods.
Yes.
But there's just something about being able to follow a person that I really enjoy. And mm-hmm. I'm more than happy to be that person if it means that somebody can sort of say, oh, you know, check out this middle-class white chick eating something that I thought was scary. Maybe I can do it too. I think that's really powerful.
Yeah, I totally
agree.
I think
there's a lot of merit in that.
Mm-hmm. Are you... like, how do you feel storytelling is around the hospitality industry at the moment? Do you think it's, you know, do you think it's as connected to the culture with inside the venues, the actual food that's coming out? Because I feel like we've gone through a situation like the last 5 or 10 years where we've focused a lot on fit outs and things like that of new venues which have come through. Like, do you think we're focusing enough on the actual storytelling like you are so well doing?
I think there's going to be quite a lot of change over the next year to 18 months, or I hope there is anyway.
Mm.
I think the same formats are tired and they won't work forever.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think reviewing is going to change. I think it has to change.
Yeah.
And that's there won't be storytelling necessarily, or maybe there will be. I think if you start storytelling, it sort of doesn't become a review. It becomes
yes.
a feature.
Correct.
And people really do get confused about that. I mean, you look at a publication like Broadsheet versus Good Food.
Mm.
Good Food, you know, Jemima does an amazing job at the reviews there, and Danny as well on the weekends, Danny Gillette. But then you look at Broadsheet and people say, oh, we got reviewed by Broadsheet. Whereas you ask anyone at Broadsheet and they'll tell you they don't do reviews, they do reporting.
Yes.
So people don't even understand what it is and who's doing what at the moment. And with so many places opening and so many places closing
yes.
after the pandemic, you know, how do you condense all of that, or all of Melbourne, or all of Australia into one little book or one website?
Yeah.
I think it's nearly impossible.
Mm.
I think there are going to be more and more sort of niche publications, the same way people might specifically look for their news on, you know, whatever website because they're interested specifically in sport or
yep.
specifically in vegan food only, people start to really nitpick the kind of content and news that they want to consume.
Yes.
And I think the same thing will probably happen with restaurants if it isn't already.
Yeah, yeah, I totally agree. Like, reviews are a very interesting thing. I'm curious how, like, obviously not reviews in places like Good Food, like Danny does an amazing job, like but yeah, just reviews across the border, I'm curious how people trust them, I suppose, as a general rule, and I think maybe influencer marketing, you know, especially has contributed to that the last couple of years as well. So
yeah, of course. And then the influencers are just a whole other ball game, right? I mean, yes. they review, they're still reviews. I guess traditionally with food critics, you trust them based on their experience. You know, they do this every week, multiple times a week.
Yes.
Paid to do it.
Yes.
Whether you like them or not is different. The conversation that's shifting now is a lot about who gets to be a food reviewer, who yes. gets to talk about food from other cultures. Mm. You know, is it somebody who studied journalism? Is it a chef? Is it somebody who's Chinese reviewing a Chinese restaurant? Is it someone who's Indian reviewing a Chinese restaurant?
Yeah.
Everybody from every background should be able to review any restaurant.
Yeah.
But you do have to know what you're talking about.
How do you think we qualify that?
It's really, really hard. I think the best thing you can do is support the people who are interested,
yeah.
who are coming up to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And there aren't enough resources around in media and journalism for the big publications to do that. I mean, everybody wants to do it. Nobody has the time. Everybody's understaffed. Some people argue that's no excuse, but you know, ultimately the power is removed from a lot of the editorial decision makers
yeah.
by people further up. So there is room. I think there's a huge gap for whoever has the money to set a really, really, really good example for everybody else. Maybe start something new, whether that's a food guide or a really independent website
yep.
where, you know, you can afford to not only nurture young and up and coming critics and food writers and feature writers from all different backgrounds, but also to, you know, revisit a restaurant more than once in case it has a bad night, like back in the good old days, instead of just going once based on the press release from the PR company that represents the same, you know, sort of five big names that you'd see regurgitated in all the papers and broadsheets again and yeah. again and again.
Yes.
But, you know, it takes a lot of resources. So who's going to do it? Someone, I hope.
Yeah, it's going to become, I think, an even more fragmented sort of landscape, you know, over the next couple of years, I think, which may be a positive. I'm not sure. You know, maybe it'll allow certain pockets to actually have, you know, a voice where they may not have got a voice before. So, I mean, that's yeah. something that may come out positively.
And this is all without even talking about social media, which yes. I think has so much more pull than it ever, ever has.
Yes.
So you can't just talk about the media landscape in terms of traditional publications anymore. It's,
100%.
It's driven and led by individual, I guess you'd call them, thought leaders or whatever the technical term for it is in marketing.
Yes.
But it changes and it's opinionated and, you know, are people talking about what they're being paid for enough? Is it sort of hidden away? You just, it's hard to know what's real and what's not.
Mm, yeah, I totally agree. You are obviously deeply connected to a lot of people in this industry. Melbourne especially has had obviously an awful time as we tape this in November, the last 6 months, 7 months, however long this has been going for.
What is time?
I don't even remember. I don't remember when this started anymore. How do you feel, you know, the restaurateurs, the owners are coping at the moment and feeling as we sort of head into a hopeful summer of, you know, outdoor dining and maybe things easing, you know, restrictions wise even more? Like what kind of conversations are you having with people in the industry at the moment?
Do we swear on this podcast or
we can not? Swear as much as we fucking want, Sophia.
Well, they are fucking excited and they are fucking terrified.
Yeah.
In some. The words that I hear the most are excited and nervous.
Yeah.
And nobody really knows what's gonna happen. I think the pandemic has sort of shed a light, especially on what's broken in this industry, what works and what doesn't work.
Yes.
The question is, what happens when JobKeeper dries up completely? And what good habits do we take forward? And a lot of that will come down to dine-in demand. I mean, you look at people doing set menus now, where previously they only did a la carte, they yes. do multiple sittings. It might not be as relaxing an experience for a diner who only has an hour and a half or 2 hours, but I can guarantee you the quality is going to be far superior because yes. there's more control from the end of the restaurant. But do people want to pay $100 up front or give their credit card details or be happy to pay a no-show fee if they're assholes and don't show
yeah.
up?
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of people still aren't. It's a huge change of habit and the way that we've done things for a very, very long time.
Mm.
So I sort of hope that just the more restaurants who do that, who have set times, who take prepayments, who do take charge and take control of their systems, if enough places do that at the same time, then the diner just doesn't really have a choice. If they want to go to those restaurants, they're going to have to jump on the bandwagon.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be a really, really great thing for the hospitality industry in general.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. There has, you know, I just hope there's something that's going to come positively out of this, and I want to get your thoughts on that in a second. Before you just reminded me of something as you told that that story there. When I was doing the research on you the last couple of weeks, I love the fact that you did a post on Instagram basically saying "Don't be a dick." And was it the 10 or 12 reasons?
There were 12, but 12. I can tell you what, I can probably think of more.
Yeah, like where did that come about? Because we sort of saw a lot a bit of a movement in Sydney a couple of months ago when people were doing no shows to venues when they were making reservations, which is just such a dick move. You know, like, so how did that come about that you did, you know, 12 reasons to not be a dick? Like, was it just a conversation you were having with people in the industry? Was it something that you know just felt?
The week before restaurants reopened, so I guess it was the announcement, I went from being not incredibly busy to incredibly busy. I was asked to write 3 separate features on restaurants reopening for 3 separate publications, an opinion piece, a major story, and a cover all within 1 week. And they were all covering the same thing, which was, you know, how do restaurants feel? What is the vibe going to be like in, you know, the ghost town that is the CBD?
Yeah.
What's it actually like dining back that first week? And there were a lot of conversations I had that I couldn't squeeze into those features, mainly because they weren't necessarily appropriate. There were some tips and tricks and, you know, do's and don'ts, but there was just so much more that wasn't covered. And just hearing the stories from people about things, in particular no-shows, which just blows my mind, especially when restrictions at that point, most people could only seat 10.
Yeah.
And even still, there are some restaurants that can only seat 10 legally, even though you can seat 40 inside with all the proper per square meter each and all of that. And just to think that, you know, there'd be tables of 6 or 8 for a room of 10 who just wouldn't show up. That can close a restaurant, you know, when it's like living paycheck to paycheck for rent. And on your credit card bills, when you've got to pay your staff, your rent, your electricity, your suppliers, your wine guy, all of this stuff, and then someone doesn't turn up, you can't cover the bills.
Mm.
So that was the first one, was definitely don't be a no-show.
Mm-hmm.
But then there was a lot of other confusion around just what was general etiquette and what wasn't, such as, you know, when to wear your mask, what can you do as a diner to make the conversation with wait staff as comfortable as possible, because nobody wants to say, hey mate, you know, would you mind just doing this?
Yeah,
that makes it awkward straight away. But it's you know, it's their responsibility to keep their staff and their customers safe.
Yes.
And you can't get shitty at them for that. It's their job.
Yeah, it's like I imagine that, you know, you as well as me would have just, you know, you're pretty much almost out every night the last couple of weeks because, you know, you want to support venues and you haven't been sat down in a venue for like 5 months. And just some of the shit that I've seen, and, you know, great hospitality leaders having to tell guests to wear their mask when they're walking around and going to the toilet. Like, it's just such a silly conversation when you walk into a venue and they're doing everything right and they tell you everything off the bat. And then they're having to just have silly conversations or, you know, can you just be a bit more distant or whatever. I'm struggling to feel for the people who are, you know, saying they can't get into venues or whatever because so many people are not acting right in venues when they're actually going. It's, I don't know what the solution is, but Yeah.
It's really frustrating. And there is definitely a case of the vocal minority. I mean, I've had a lot of comments on articles
for
actual people to just like, just fucking wear your mask. It's not that hard. And then you've got people arcing up saying, well, actually, for me, it is hard because I've got this, that, and the other. That's fine. Mm. You can get an exemption. Go to the doctor, get the note. Don't sit there and complain. Mm. Do the right thing. It's, you know, you give people an inch and they take a mile.
Yes.
And I'll stand by that. And I'm happy to be criticized as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
The rule is wear a mask. If it's really that hard for you, get takeaway and have it at home.
Exactly.
Or get an exemption and don't wear your mask.
Yeah.
Don't just complain about it but not follow the rules, because every fucking other person, every other restaurant is following the rules. So why do you get to be better or different from them?
Yeah.
It's not very community minded.
Do you feel there's been, like, especially in the last week, I've noticed a bit of a beat up on venues for saying potentially not doing the right thing? Like, have you felt that sort of come through? I felt that's like Wes Lambert from, you know, the Caterers and Restaurants Association has basically been in the media every day, like trying to almost shelter or protect venues who are doing the right thing at the moment. Do you know where this is coming from? Do you feel that's a valid thing that's being
said?
Yeah,
definitely. It's a two-way street. I can, you know, sit here and talk about diners doing the wrong thing as much as I like, but there are restaurants doing the wrong thing.
Mm.
And again, that's unfair for all the restaurants who are doing the right thing.
Yeah, totally.
So, you know, you follow the rules, and the big one there is capacity. How many patrons can you have actually sitting there?
Yes.
And that has a huge impact on your bottom line.
Yes.
So if you're just, you know, going to ignore the room rule, which changed from having separate rooms to either having a divider or a 5-meter gap between rooms.
Yes.
And you said it's a podcast, you probably can't do it all the time.
Yes, inverted commas gap. Rooms.
You know, if you're just going to squeeze an extra 10, 20 people in there when someone else is doing the right thing, it's just not an even playing field.
Yeah.
And then you've got, I mean, I've been to venues where a lot of people in kitchens are not wearing their masks properly.
Yeah,
maybe their nose is hanging out. Maybe they're just down under their chin. And, you know, it's just a facade that they've got it on their face. They're not actually doing the right thing. And I know it's hot and stinky and sweaty and hard enough to breathe in a kitchen in front of an oven as it is.
Yeah.
But God, we're in an era of open kitchens, and I've had so many messages from customers who are really uncomfortable seeing that.
Yeah.
So the same way you want a customer to be comfortable just, you know, having a glass of wine and sitting there on a seat that's nice and plush, you want them to feel comfortable when they look at you. I mean, the same way you wouldn't rock into work as a staff member with your shirt off.
Yes. Yeah,
that
exactly.
Makes uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's a good way
same
to put
way,
it.
Wear your mask properly, and all it means is that your customer will feel comfortable, and then they'll come back, or they'll tell other people about what a great experience they had and go and support X restaurant because their everything was clean, the food was fantastic. It was weird because it's post-COVID lockdown time, so, you know, they made a joke about it and it was really nice. Because the alternative is they'll tell 10 times more people about the chef in the kitchen who had his mask hanging around his ears and wasn't doing it properly. The same way you'd comment if you found a hair in your food or someone sneezed into it without covering their mouth.
Yeah.
It's a brave new world, and everyone has to do the right thing until masks can be removed. It's just all about trying to get back to normal as quickly as possible.
Yep.
And people who don't play by the rules are just going to make it really hard for everyone else.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to get your thoughts on this if I can. In Melbourne, obviously, like, I've had 4 separate conversations with 4 different venues the last couple of days saying they cannot get staff.
Yeah.
They're busy and they can't get stuff. I think it's because we've not, as a whole, haven't been in industry, haven't treated our overseas staff very well, and a lot of them have gone back home and haven't come back. Like, do you see, like, what do you feel the reason is? Do you feel it's because of, you know, a lot of overseas workers who have gone back home? Do you feel it's just people don't want to work in the industry anymore because of, you know, they're getting government payments or whatever's happening there? Like, do you have a general feeling about what's going to happen?
I have a specific feeling that it is 100% because we didn't support our temporary visa holders, and they were given no choice but to find other jobs or leave the country altogether.
Yeah.
And that's going to come back and bite us in the ass. And it's something that has already happened in Sydney. It's already happened overseas. And now it's happening here in Melbourne. That's 100% what it is.
Yeah. What do you think we can learn from that as an industry? Because obviously, you know, the amount of people that I've hired in my time have been from overseas. Like, there's been a lot, right? And I've always tried to make sure that we're paying them correctly. We're not paying them in cash. We're making sure they get superannuation. We make sure they're treated respectfully. All those different things. Like, what do you think? Do you think the industry is going to learn anything from this? Or do you think they're just going to get through it and then we're going to have, you know, international workers back again and we're just going to do the same thing again and not treat them properly?
I don't think it's an industry problem. I think it's probably much broader than that. Mm. I think any industry beyond hospitality, whether that's backpackers picking berries,
yeah,
which I know is a huge problem, or, you know, being in the vineyards that come harvest,
yes,
or through to, I don't know, junior staff working in law firms or junior doctors, like a lot of people, Victoria, Australia, why, are from overseas. Everyone's from bloody overseas unless you've got Indigenous blood, really. It just depends how many generations you've lived here for.
Yeah.
And you know, we harp on about being a multicultural society and being accepting and all of this, but when the legislation doesn't reflect that in a time of crisis in terms of support, you're full of shit. Like, your government's full of shit is what it is.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the best thing that you can do as an individual is bug the people in power as much as you possibly can and, you know, sign petitions, send letters, all of that, because it's going to be really damaging. You know, we rely on people from overseas to make up a much bigger part of our workforce than just hospitality.
Yes.
So we're going to need them. We're going to need them back. And people are going to be short-staffed for a very long time. And that's going to be a really hard gap to fill.
Is it a hard story to tell? Is it a hard story to get out about the kind of mistreatment, you know, of those workers around the country? Like, you know, from a journalistic sort of perspective, is it? We sort of hear about it occasionally. You know, the ABC does quite a good job of talking about these kind of issues. Do you think it's just a hard story that doesn't come out very much? Like, do you think we need to talk about it more or?
I think the more you talk about anything, the more you talk about anything, the more likely it is to change.
Yeah.
So I don't think there's such thing as too much coverage. Maybe it's because of the circles that I run in and the people I follow on Instagram, but I feel like it's been a big part of the conversation throughout the sort of lockdown COVID pandemic period. So I'm kind of surrounded by it and really aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
What will be interesting is, you know, in 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, 12 months time to see where the industry is at and how much of what's happening then is related to anything from overseas workers through to the super fast adoption of technology, through to just restaurant dining processes changing, through to consumer expectations of what it means to eat in a restaurant in 2021 and beyond.
Yes, yeah. Let's talk about a couple of positive things to finish off the podcast. There are going to be a lot of shifts in the industry over the next couple of years, obviously. Do you think what kind of positive things are you looking forward to that maybe we haven't done before that you think are going to happen now in the industry, like things like outdoor dining and that kind of stuff? Are you looking forward to that? Like, what are you looking forward to the most?
I am so pumped about summer. This is very short-term future and outdoor dining.
Yeah.
I think it's just so fantastic. Like, fuck Melbourne weather. We always find a way. I mean, the amount of times I've sat on a balcony all rubbed up with a glass of wine. You can just do it in a restaurant as well.
Yes.
I mean, haven't people heard of mulled wine? Like, heat the parklets during winter. It'll be fine.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Some heaters. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're a fairly sprawled out city and state compared to, you know, anywhere really else in the world. You look at Japan, Tokyo, London, anywhere in the UK, New York.
Mm-hmm.
We have so much space. And I think these parklets in particular, these outdoor dining hubs, it's just such a good vibe. I mean, just walking around the city and around my area in the inner north, when you see the concrete blocks, it's like a beacon of hope. Yes, there's another one coming. you know, places like Gerald's Bar in Carlton, I was there, and the next day they were putting up their parklet. Mm-hmm. I mean, that place has needed more seats since it existed. I mean, it's hard enough to get a table there, and to see that full when people sort of spinning their little umbrellas in the sun. That's so lovely, and it's such a good vibe. And you know, you want to talk about Melbourne getting back to being the most livable city in the world. Well, we absolutely fucking are at the moment, because we have no COVID, pretty much.
Yeah, exactly.
And we've got all this amazing outdoor space for summer.
Yeah.
So yeah, I hope that continues, and I hope local councils, government helps support it as well.
Yeah,
because
I agree.
It's not just good for the hospitality industry.
Yeah.
It's good for reinvigorating all the jobs and all the tourism and all the positive aspects that come with that. So no, I'm pumped for outdoor dining. That's something that I hope stays. I hope the other thing that I'm hoping that people, this is sort of a negative positive. I sort of hope that in a lot of decades old favorites closing for good and people being quite shocked and thinking, God, that place was always so busy.
Yeah.
I hope the average punter realizes that just being a busy restaurant doesn't necessarily equate to a good restaurant business model.
Yes.
So I hope there's a renewed appreciation of what it means to dine out.
Yeah.
So I mean, we're so spoiled in Melbourne, going out four times a week, excluding brunch. That's ridiculous. I mean, we need to pay more for food. We need to be happy with paying more so that people can pay their staff, not even more, just properly, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, absolutely.
I really want the industry to thrive as an industry and go from sort of being a love job, something that people are just passionate about, to something where people can actually make a living and be passionate about it. So hopefully the pandemic and not being able to go out, and now being able to go out, but everything that comes around that, whether it's prepaid meals or giving your credit card booking in case you happen to end up being a no-show.
Yes.
All of that, I just want people to accept that and really get behind it. And I think that will change the industry or really start a snowball effect.
Yeah.
Because, Melbourne is hospitality. And if we want to stay that way, we really need to make some big changes.
Yeah. Some awesome insight. I've been pondering this the last couple of months. Do you think people will probably eat out less, but then spend more money when they do, and sort of treat it like a almost more celebrationary rather than every day? Like, because I remember when I sort of joined the industry 20 years ago, it was like that. You wouldn't go to a restaurant every week. You maybe go to a restaurant every 2 weeks or every 4 weeks. Like, it was much more around a celebration or for a reason, where now people, it's just part of what we do, and that's an amazing thing. Like, do you think it will change that at all? Or do you think it would just sort of go back to normal in the next
six months? No, I don't think that will change. I think part of the, one of the great things about being in a city like Melbourne is that you can go out often.
Mm.
What will probably happen is that you'll see the restaurants change and what's available will change.
Yep.
So a few things, I guess. I'm most worried about that mid section of hospitality. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got fine dining, people who are switching to set menus and presenting beautiful, definitely special occasion food.
Yes.
That will always have a place, top level service like Flower Drum. That's not going anywhere.
Yep.
At the other end of the scale, you've got cheap eats, whatever that means.
Yep.
And I think you have to be really aware of what that means. So, does that mean your chicken is not free range? Are you fine with that? Are you not fine with that?
Yep.
Does it mean that there are processes in place that are sustainable, whether that's talking about paying staff or talking about the environment?
Yep.
Things like that, all the margins involved. Generally, when you're eating something that's really cheap, there's someone somewhere that's probably either not being treated right or being taken advantage of. And maybe there's, maybe it's a family-run restaurant and everyone's just in it together and that's their decision and that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But I think cheap eats, whatever that means, will always exist, and the top end of the spectrum, fine dining, will always exist.
Mm-hmm.
What's going to probably change the most is that middle end of the spectrum, which is probably the most Melbourne,
yes,
as well. You know, so you're talking about, you know, fancy snacks and natural wine bars and, you know, sort of, I don't know, call it $60 to $90 a head restaurants. I think technology will end up playing a big part there, keeping staff costs down.
Yeah,
so you'll still have the extremely amicable person at the front showing you in and asking you if you need anything, but you're probably going to be seeing a lot more QR code menus.
Yeah.
And once that technology is in place, you're not going to go back to paper.
No, no, it's not turning back, is it? Like if you're paying from a QR code or an app or whatever, like that venue's not going back, you know?
Yeah.
Especially if that average ticket goes up. Like it's not going back to what it was before.
Mm. And there's been a lot around, a lot of sort of, I guess you'd almost call it proof or case studies, especially in Sydney, that some of these apps, like Me and You is one that's around, average spend per head goes up when you don't have to sort of consider whether you want another beer or not. You can just click the button and order it really quickly.
Yeah.
So that's great. I mean, I'd love people to spend more money.
Yes.
That'd be ideal. But, you know, it's a global pandemic. A lot of people who still don't have jobs and who are going to be in a really shitty place when JobKeeper finishes. So you can't. There needs to be something for everybody in terms of price point. And hospitality will always have that for everyone.
Yeah. Yeah. There'll always be something at your range that you can purchase. That's a really good point. My last question to you, Sophia. What are you looking forward to getting back to that you can't quite do now?
I feel bad saying travel when I've been thinking about how much I love Melbourne and love hospitality for this entire podcast so far. But I am really looking forward to getting away. Part of the reason I love going away is because it's a cliche thing to say, but travel really does inform my worldview, and I think everybody's worldview, and it really makes you realize how much we have back at home, also here in Melbourne.
Great point.
So I'm looking forward to traveling more. I'm looking forward to getting out and about and filming more. I haven't been able to sort of do many on the ground interviews for screen, especially with all the masks and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And just looking forward to getting out and exploring different pockets of my own neighborhood further afield, just see what gems are out there that, you know, maybe I took for granted previously. Yep,
that you want to uncover.
Well, they're, you know, uncover for me. So I'm hardly the discoverer. I'm just a chronic researcher.
Well, I'm glad to see what you're going to research and discover next with the great media that you do. It's a really tribute to you. You do fantastic work. So it's been really exciting to have you on today's podcast. So thanks so much. What's the best way that people can follow you and find out about what you're doing here in Melbourne and obviously in your travel as well?
Sure. So Seasoned Traveller is a good one. So the website will be live by the end of this year, but the newsletters are already currently up and firing. So that's seasonedtraveller.com.
Awesome.
And then Instagram's a good one as well.
Yeah, so your Instagram's awesome.
Me, which is Sophia K. Levin. Sophia Levin was taken.
And my name's really?
Sophia with an F, so F-I-A, K-L-E-V-I-N. And also Seasoned Traveller HQ is another way to get some of those snippets of places that might not be on the radar of mainstream media and that can help you sort of celebrate diversity through food and travel with your taste buds without necessarily having to jump on a plane.
Yeah, that's awesome. And if you didn't quite catch that, they're always in the show notes, so you can always click and connect with Sophia and follow her story. Sophia Levin, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for tuning to another episode of the Open Pantry Podcast. I hope you really enjoyed it. As always, please make sure you subscribe to the podcast so you know when it's coming out. We try to put out 1 to 2 a week to make sure you get the best hospitality information. And make sure you share it with people as well. If you really enjoy it, you really like it, please share it so the hospitality podcast gets even bigger in the coming year. Stay safe, stay well. Till next time. Take care.